This is the final session in our speaker series for the new guide training for this year. So we're pretty excited about that, the last session. This afternoon, we have an extraordinary speaker guest. I'm honored and somewhat humbled to be introducing him. So John Briscoe is the president of the San Francisco Historical Society. He's a restaurant co-owner. He's an author, a poet, and in his spare time, he's a highly accomplished trial attorney. So he's here to talk about the history of San Francisco restaurants and cuisine. John, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here, and thank you for the introduction. It was a little over the top, and now it makes me apprehensive that I won't live up to billing. But you have asked me, Roger, as I've done in the past, to speak on one of my favorite subjects, San Francisco history, and in particular, the culinary history of San Francisco, or gastronomic history of San Francisco. And at least I cannot separate that any more than I can separate my food from my wine. I cannot separate that subject from the subject of California wine. So I'll weave that throughout my little talk this afternoon, and be very San Francisco focused as I do talk about wine. To begin at the beginning, it's written in many, many history books that San Francisco had three foundings. That's the old, oft-repeated story. The first was the Presidio of San Francisco, which was founded in September of 1776, the same year that the United States, on July 4th, declared its independence from Great Britain. And the mission of San Francisco, what we call Mission Dolores, that was founded a month later on October 9th, 1776. At this time, California was a Spanish territory. If it's incomprehensible, a country that's today only 40 million people, something like that, 45 million people, at that time, less than half of that, and yet they ruled most of Latin America, all of the American West, the Philippines, Guam, and on. I mean, just as an administrative burden, the internet was very slow at that time. I don't know how they did it, but beginning in 1769, they began to colonize California with the first of 21 missions, and in 1776, first with the Presidio, a month later, the mission in San Francisco. That was, those twin events are sometimes considered two foundings of San Francisco. In 1835, San Francisco, then called Yerba Buena, became a pueblo under Spanish law, which was very, very specific. This entitled the pueblo, or little city of San Francisco, to be entitled to 6 square leagues of land, which was to be its birthright many, many years later when it needed the land. And those are considered to be the three birth dates of San Francisco. You noticed I didn't mention the Ohlones, the many, many different tribes of Ohlones with their different dialects who lived here, because they're simply ignored by historians, or have been until very recently. The great USF historian, a Jesuit, John McGloin, wrote in 1978 his great book on San Francisco history, quote, "The historical record makes it abundantly clear that San Francisco was founded in three stages, first as a presidio, soon after as a Franciscan mission, and finally as a pueblo." Close quotes. No mention in Father McGloin's book whatsoever of the native peoples who live here. I will simply touch on that a little later, because I think with more and more awakening, that issue in San Francisco and elsewhere is going to be of ever increasing importance. And what's all this history have to do with food? My point is this. Now let's go forward to 1847. So the nominal beginning, if you forget the Ohlones, and there was a deliberate attempt to exterminate, I use that word advisedly, the native peoples. If you ignore them, then the nominal founding of San Francisco happened in the fall of 1776. There was a status conferred, Pueblo status, in 1835. But who was here? We have an 1847 census that gives us the answer to that question. Fewer than 500 people were resident of San Francisco in 1847. In 1848, on January 24th, gold was discovered in Sutter's, in a mill race that John Marshall was building for that Swiss man up in Coloma, California. Word got back to San Francisco of the discovery of gold on the American River, and there was a little gold rush here in San Francisco during the summer. People stopped what they were doing and they went up there and they panned for gold, and that was pretty much it. That's not the gold rush that historians talk about. In December of 1848, and so mind you, the population of California, of San Francisco, is no doubt still a few people less than 500, because the census that pegged it, I want to say, at 447 was just the year before. December 5th, 1848, President Polk gave his State of the Union address to the country and to the world. At that time, it was given at a different, you know, point during the year. Today, it's typically given in January. In his State of the Union address, President Polk announced to the world that the gold rush in California, that the discovery of gold in California, I should say, was real, was actual. There was gold there, and everybody from the four corners of the earth was free to come and get it. I neglected to put one date in here. January 24th was the date of the discovery of gold. It was 9 days later, in a little suburb, Guadalupe Hidalgo, of Mexico City, that the Mexicans signed the treaty ending the Mexican War with the United States and ceded to the United States, hold your breath, most of Colorado and Wyoming, 98% of Arizona, all of New Mexico, Nevada, Utah, and California, just like that. The Mexicans presumably had not heard of the discovery of gold 9 days earlier in California. So President Polk gives the State of the Union address on December 5th, 1848, and that precipitates what we think of as the gold rush. He lent credence to it. Remember, there's no transcontinental railroad, there's no Panama Canal. How do people get word of things going on out here in California, back on the east, very slowly? In 1821, Mexico had gained independence from Spain. So at this point in time, at the time of the treaty, 1848, Mexico was sovereign, not Spain. It took the Spanish authorities in California 1 year to learn that Spain was no longer in control of California, but the new Mexican government in Mexico City was. That's how slow communication was. So it's no great surprise that on February the 2nd, 1848, when the Mexican and American negotiators signed the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, that the Mexicans did not know what they were signing away. All right. So the gold rush, the big gold rush, the real gold rush happens in 1849. What happened to San Francisco, the primary port of entry, right? The gold fields are just inland of here. People typically did not go to San Diego or to Los Angeles in search of gold or in search of a fortune to be built around gold, like making tents, Levi Strauss, opening hardware stores, Collis Huntington. No, they came to San Francisco. Nobody knows what happened, population-wise, but by the end of the year, from a population of fewer than 500 people, on January 1, the population swelled to 25,000 or 45,000 or 50,000 people. Nobody knows. There was no federal authority. This was federal territory. There's no state of California. There's federal, this is federal territory, but it's lawless. And the few law enforcement officials that were there for the little tiny Pueblo of San Francisco were totally overwhelmed. Hence, the Committee of Vigilance, the vigilantes that tried to control crime during this period. So I mention all of this so that you reflect that the real birth of San Francisco as a city, not as an Indian village, not as a Mexican Pueblo or a Spanish mission, the real birth of San Francisco as a city is probably best pegged at 1849, and the population has risen ever since, as we all know. So let's compare that to other cities, older cities on the east. New York was founded in 1624, Boston in 1630, Charleston in 1670, Philadelphia in 1682. If I can do my numbers right, San Francisco is 225 years younger than New York. And yet, of the five oldest restaurants in the United States today, none is in New York, and three is in San Francisco, and yet we're 225 years younger. Okay, that could be a quirk of statistics, of economics, the restaurant business is difficult and so forth, but I think, that factoid, and some others that I'm going to be giving you, is of the piece with something else. So again, take 1849 as the real birth date of San Francisco as a city. Not later than 20 years later, 1869, the greatest food writer of all time, at least in Western civilization, a prolific food writer, a most authoritative food writer, a Frenchman, very prominent Frenchman, wrote, "After Paris, the greatest restaurant city in the world is San Francisco." Take that in. In fewer than 20 years, this Frenchman learns, or has come to the opinion, that San Francisco, after Paris, is the second greatest food city, restaurant city in the world. How on earth did that happen? There is no Panama Canal still. 1869 was the driving of the Golden Spike at Promontory Point, Utah. So the Transcontinental Railroad started up that year. I've searched and searched and searched and can find no record that this Frenchman, in his life's work, I'll get back to who he is in a moment, ever came to San Francisco. And yet he made this bold statement. The second greatest city wasn't Marseille or Nice, as you would expect a Frenchman to say, but San Francisco, way out in just newly acquired California. At this point, California had been American for 21 years, and he had never been there. What was it? What had happened to establish San Francisco as such a great, notoriously great restaurant city in so little time? let me add a brief parenthesis right here to my remarks about the Olones. Remember I used the word extermination? California became a state in 1850. It was never a legal territory of the United States. It was a possession beginning with the treaty with Mexico, February 2, 1848. On September 9, 1850, Congress passed and the president signed a bill admitting California to the Union, as a free state. There was a big point of contention. Would it be slave? Would it be free? California's first governor was a man named Peter Hardiman Burnett of San Francisco. On January 6, 1851, barely 4 months, not even 4 months, after California had begun as a state, he gave his State of the Union address. Listen to these words. A war of extermination will continue to be waged until the Indian race becomes extinct in California. This was official policy from the beginning. Benjamin Madley, who studied history, he's from the Bay Area, he teaches history at UCLA now, came out with a brilliant book in 2016 called An American Genocide, where he gathered together the facts. And the population of the native Californian diminished by 95% from 350,000 at contact, 1542, San Diego, Cabrillo's landing, from 350,000 in that year to 18,000 in the census of 1880, the official United States census. That's a 95% drop. And as Madley points out in his book, the primary cause, not syphilis and smallpox and suicides because of the depression of the captive Indians and everything else, but the primary cause was hunting parties dispatched by people like Serranus Hastings, who was the state's first chief justice. Hastings Law School is named for him. And most of all, Leland Stanford, who was protecting his title to lands that properly belonged to Indians and signed into law when he was governor of California, many bills appropriating money for the Mariposa Battalion, which wiped out the Indian tribes in Yosemite Valley and so many other places. So enough of that, but I just wanted, if you haven't been acquainted with that, it's very recent scholarship. The book has been praised by reviewers and critics. Again, it's An American Genocide, Benjamin Madley, M-A-D-L-E-Y. Now, let me leave you with those questions, really, about how on earth in 20 years California, San Francisco could have attained a reputation as the second greatest food city on earth. And let me switch over to California wine. The first California wine grapes were probably planted in 1770. This is another of my books. They weren't planted in 1769 in San Diego, but at one of the other Southern California missions very soon. And the Spanish Padres, the Franciscan Padres, made wine for table use and for sacramental use. Wine is used in the Catholic Mass. But almost from the start, it was a while before there was commercial winemaking, that is, not by the church, not by the missions. And it began in Los Angeles. And from the very beginning, people in the wine business were writing and talking about how perfect California is situated to make wines the equal of the great wines of Europe. And I have many notes here about some of those winemakers and so forth, but and if you ever get into it, there are many contestants for the title of Father of California Wine. Back then, there were no mothers of California wine. All the vineyard owners and the winemakers were men. So that's not a sexist remark, and besides, that's just how the industry refers to it. Count Augustin Harasti, a Hungarian, was officially bestowed the title Father of California Wine by the state legislature in 1949. He founded Buena Vista Winery, which is still the oldest winery in California. I want to say in 1856, but I could be wrong. It's right there. And the winery right down the road, Gunlach Bunshu, both in Sonoma County, right outside the town of Sonoma, was founded just a month later, and it's the second oldest. I deliberately did not say continuously operating winery, because we had that little episode called Prohibition in this country. So we don't have any wineries that were continuously operating, except for a handful like Christian Brothers that made wine for sacramental purposes during Prohibition. Many people competed to be historians, that, you know, nerds like me who have gotten into this, who can be said to be the father of California wine. Well, Horasti has that official title bestowed by the state of California upon him. But long before him, in Los Angeles, in the early part of the 19th century, one of the very successful first commercial winemakers in California was a man from Bordeaux. He did not come from a winemaking family. He was himself a cooper. That was his trade, but he got into wine and he saw that California could produce. He was one of the first to write friends back in Europe and up in San Francisco, that, which wasn't San Francisco then, that California had everything it took to produce great wines. His name was Jean-Louis Vigne, V-I-G-N-E-S, which my high school French tells me is vines or vineyards in French, which would seem to make him a much more suitable choice to be the father of California wine than Augustin Horasti, which I can barely pronounce, and I'm sure I'm mispronouncing it now. A man named Kohler in the latter part of the 19th century is also a contestant for that title, and of course the famous Robert Mondavi. So winemaking began in Southern California, and which comes as a shock to a lot of people. When it moved to Northern California, it did not begin in Napa. It began in Sonoma. And I'll get back to that in a moment, but I wanted you to get a flavor of all of that and ponder this too. So there were people writing and talking about the potential for California wines as being as good as the greatest European wines, particularly the French, as early as the 1820s. And yet, and the first wine grapes were planted in 1770, maybe 1771. And yet, it took more than 200 years from then for California wines to be recognized as, if not the equal, perhaps the better in one memorable wine tasting at least, than the European wines. And so when you say, how did San Francisco become the second greatest food city on earth in fewer than 20 years, pair that with the question, why did it take so long, more than 200 years, for California wines to attain to their great status that they enjoy today? What took so long? Let's go back to California food for a second, San Francisco food, the restaurant scene here. And I'm going to take you to an improbable building, 608 Commercial Street. I would ask you all to raise your hand if you can picture the building, but I can't see any of you. 608 Commercial Street is just off Montgomery, just west of Montgomery on the north side of Commercial. It's an old building. It's a landmark building. It was the West's first mint. It was built as a private mint. It was acquired by the United States Treasury in 1852. And a new mint building was constructed on the site, and it opened in 1854. The first superintendent, the first chief assayer, not sure he held the title of superintendent, was Augustin Horasti, the putative father of California wine. I dropped that to mention that the building goes on. The building today is the museum of the San Francisco Historical Society, We acquired the property last August. And soon after we had installed our exhibits and opened it up, we had to close it down for COVID-19. So you can't get in there right now, but we hope to be up and running soon because it has all this fascinating history. We're a block from Portsmouth Square. Commercial Street, as I'm sure you all know now, from Montgomery out, in beginning in the Gold Rush, was Long Wharf, a great, I think it was a mile and a half long, extended into the bay. Today it's just an extension of Commercial Street until it's abandoned, I want to say, at Embarcadero 2. I'm not sure. There is a Commercial Street by Embarcadero 1, but I think it was abandoned for number 2 and number 3. One significance about that abandonment was years ago I was looking for the original location of Tadich Grill, the oldest restaurant in San Francisco, 1849, the year of the Gold Rush, and the third oldest restaurant in the country. And if you can picture walking into the ground level of Embarcadero 3, the shops and all of that, from the time it opened in the 1970s, late 70s, I believe, there's been a barbershop. The walls are glass, right in the middle of the first floor. That is where Tadich Grill was, 27 Long Wharf, in its original location. Okay, back west now, we're at the Old Mint. Horosny gets in trouble. He's charged with, in effect, falsifying the books and perhaps pocketing some gold on his way home. He has his legal battles with the United States Treasury for many years, and partly because of that, he throws more and more time into wine, and he really did some remarkable things for California wine. Now, a few years later, the Mint hires a man named Bret Harte as clerk and secretary to the superintendent at the Old Mint. I should call it the Old Mint, because we all tend to think of the building right across from the Chronicle building at Fifth and Mission as the Old Mint. We'll think of the Commercial Street building as the Old Mint, or the real Old Mint, to distinguish it. So Bret Harte is hired. Finally, he's got a bit of a sinecure. In 1868, so the darn museum building that we have has some fascinating history. I could go on and on about the darn building, but I'm not going to get into the literary history of San Francisco here, except just briefly. Bret Harte, with an angel, founded a magazine called the Overland Monthly, which lasted well into the 20th century. And the Overland Monthly became a sensationally good literary magazine. This is volume one. I found this in a bookstore years ago. It happens to be Mayor and Senator James Phelan's. It's got his book plate. I presumed it belonged to him. It's fascinating listening to, or reading rather, the authors. Ina Kulbreth, I saw on the photo montage that was flashing on the screen during the break, picture of Ina Kulbreth, California's first poet laureate, the only woman ever admitted as a member of the Bohemian Club. A fellow named Samuel Clemens, paren Mark Twain, has a number of stories in here. The Luck of Roaring Camp by Bret Harte is in here. But the reason I call your attention to this is an extraordinary article that appeared in 1868 by Noah Brooks. Who was Noah Brooks? He was a writer. He was the Sacramento Bureau Chief, the Washington Bureau Chief for the Sacramento Union newspaper, which was the major newspaper in the state's capital at the time. He had also been a very close friend and confidant of President Lincoln, one of the few close friends that Lincoln had in Washington. They would go for long walks together. Lincoln was assassinated. He was shot the night of April 14th, 1865, and he died the next morning. I suspect that, I know I've read that Noel Brooks went into a deep depression, both over the loss of his dear friend and what it portended for the country. A couple of years later, back in San Francisco, his friend Bret Hart has put together this literary magazine and is editing it, guess where? From the Mint. All this office space, plenty of places to put out manuscripts. So when you pass that building, think, this is where Bret Hart edited all these Mark Twain pieces, went over poems by Enoch Coolbrith, composed his own many stories, and edited Noel Brooks's writing. There are a number of essays in here by Brooks, but this one is called Restaurant Life in San Francisco. It's many pages, and it's an eye-opener. This is now 19 years from San Francisco's real birth as a city in 1849. There's so much that is worth reading, but I'll read you just a little bit. He describes this phenomenal restaurant scene in San Francisco, the many different types of restaurants, ethnically, the abundance of food, the incredible presence of French chefs in San Francisco. So that's why we have such a heavy French influence on our cuisine. We still, a lot of restaurants still serve sole marguerite, classic French preparation. Here's one passage. So the restaurants of San Francisco are numerous, plenteous, inviting, and even cheap. There is abundant provision made for him whose purse is slender or whose conscience forbids him to sponge the landlord out of a costly refection. On and on. And you begin to get what happened. All these men came to San Francisco. The gold rush brought overwhelmingly men and not women. Men typically didn't know how to cook very well, unless they had very good mothers who knew their sons would do well to know how to prepare a meal for themselves and perhaps for other people. Out in California, truck farms sprouted immediately upon the gold rush. There was so much land on which to grow fruit, vegetables. Wild game was plentiful. Poultry farms for such things as eggs, that took a while because you had to set them up. But people would row, they were called eggers, E-G-G-E-R-S, row out to the Farallon Islands, clamber up those slippery rocks, and rob the moose nests for their large eggs, which would go for $10 a piece. So all of this combined, oh yes, and there was when gold was discovered, there was a Frenchman living in San Francisco, Francis Pioche, and this is late 1848. He senses what's coming. He senses that there will be a demand for people who know how to cook. What had just happened in his homeland, the Second French Revolution, where were 95% of the classically trained French chefs then? They weren't in restaurants. Some were in hotels, but they were in private households of the aristocracy, which lost their heads, many of them. And so many of these chefs were out of work. Pioche personally traveled back to Paris, and he signed up 40 of them and brought them back with him on a voyage around the Horn to San Francisco. I think it was around the Horn. The alternative was to Panama and then through the jungles and take another ship up the coast to San Francisco. But all of a sudden, there are 40 classically trained French chefs in San Francisco, One of the things that Brooks talks about in this article is that they immediately became demoralized. They were trained to prepare these rich sauces. Why? Well, flavor, yes, of course. But also, there was no electric refrigeration. So meat, and especially fish, went bad quickly. The sauces were used to mask the beginnings of the really bad part of what happens to an old fish. The people out here in San Francisco were used to a fresh salmon steak. Swordfish was brought up from Southern California on ice, but so much fresh seafood here, they didn't want their food drowned in these sauces that the Frenchmen, the French chefs, have been trained to prepare. And so the French chefs had to scale back the richness of their preparations to suit the local taste. All of these things combined. Mary Ellen Pleasant, one of the greatest cooks apparently in the United States, black woman, came out here. The first thing she did was she auctioned off her services as a cook. She held an auction and she fetched an enormous amount of money. She later became a very, very successful businesswoman. Pleasant Alley, it's about two blocks long, just north of Grace Cathedral, Nob Hill. That is after Mary Ellen Pleasant, sometimes referred to as Mammy Pleasant, though that's not respectful. She herself did not like being called Mammy. But in any event, all these forces combined to produce all of this. Now, back to that Frenchman who the following year, Noah Brooks's article is 1868. That Frenchman I referred to, who said in not later than 1869, because he died in 1870 and his book wasn't published until 3 years after the book. It's like the Oxford English Dictionary. It is called Le Grand Dictionnaire de Cuisine. And it's by Alexandre Dumas. I'm tempted to pronounce it the way my little brother always used to like to pronounce it in school to incur the wrath of his teachers, but it's Dumas. And you say, well, the author of those 250 or 260 novels, like The Count of Monte Cristo, The Three Musketeers? Yeah, that fella. That's the fella who wrote this encyclopedia of cuisine and wrote in it, after Paris, the greatest restaurant city on earth is San Francisco. The reason I say he couldn't have written it any later than 1869 is he died in early 1870. Maybe he wrote it in 1867, maybe in 1868. I've never been able to figure it out, but, and I've never been able to show, I've read biographies of him, that he ever went to San Francisco. So how could he know such a thing? Again, 1869 was the year of the Transcontinental Railroad finally being completed. He had never been out here. Well, two possible explanations. A copy of the Overland Monthly containing Bret Harte's, Noah Brooks's article fell into his possession, and he was fascinated by that. And perhaps he knew Noah Brooks. Or second, he was noted to have, shall we say, affairs. And he had many. And one of them was with the actress and entertainer Lola Montez, who spent a lot of time in San Francisco. And so perhaps she told him about the amazing culinary scene in San Francisco. But back to where would the fella have the energy to write 250, 260 novels and this encyclopedia? Well, the answer is he didn't. He wrote the encyclopedia. That was his passion. The 250 or so novels that bear his name were ghost written. And it was well known in certain circles, including with his bastard son, Dumas Fils, or son, who became a writer himself. And once when the son was a grown man, the father and son bumped into each other. They were very close. They had traveled together and whatnot. They bumped into each other on the streets of Paris, They embrace, and father says, Père says to fils, have you read my latest novel yet? And his son replied, no, father, have you? That's how well known it was that he didn't write those books, but he did write the Grand Dictionary, the Great Dictionary of Cuisine. I'm mindful of the time here. I'll get back to wine if I may, but I want to, the focus of this is to be on food, San Francisco restaurants. We've talked about the beginnings. And then there are some great books. Doris Muscatine wrote several books, but Old San Francisco, which has much on the history of restaurants in the 19th century. Her book leaves off at 1906. She was a great scholar. She had her own carol at the Bancroft Library in Berkeley. And she tells a lot about the older restaurants, the ones that cropped up during the 19th century and didn't survive the 1906 earthquake and fire. She also wrote a book. I'll show it to you in a second. I've stacked up a number of them here. But in 1963, called A Cook's Tour of San Francisco, where she gives you, in about 50 pages, a wonderful synopsis of the history of restaurants in San Francisco. In my book, Tadich Grill, I'm greatly indebted to Doris for much of the research. And thankfully, and I always thanked her, she's one of these writers who puts footnotes in her books so that you can go. I mean, it's not that I was ever dubious, doubtful of what she was saying, but I wanted to read more about it. But in the earthquake and fire, we know about that. The year after 1906, in 1907, a jewel of a book was written, Joe Tilden's Recipes for Epicures. Joe Tilden was a San Franciscan of some prominence, legendary for his dinner parties and for his recipes, for his own concoctions. And after he died, his friends got together. It's anonymously put together, but his friends got together. One friend had the recipes, and in a tribute to their departed friend, they published this jewel of a book. Let me read you the recipe for mincemeat. Measure carefully and mix together the following ingredients. 2 pounds of roast beef, finely chopped. 2 pounds of chopped beef suet. 2 pounds of chopped beef, of chopped peeled apples. 2 pounds of seeded raisins, same of sultana raisins. 2 pounds of currants. 2 pounds of white sugar. 1 pound of citron cut in bits, and you get the pieces. I'm only a fourth of the way through the ingredients. Mix them all together and you've got mincemeat for a long time. Wonderful recipes, the soup recipes at the very beginning I've tried. It's a indication of how seriously San Franciscans took their food, their restaurants. Just a few years later, so that was 1907. In 1914, a fellow, I presume, businessman, man about town named Clarence Edwards wrote Bohemian San Francisco. This isn't a collection of recipes. This is taking you through all the, I mean, there are some recipes in here, but it goes restaurant by restaurant by restaurant by restaurant in San Francisco. From the introduction, it was in Paris that a world traveler said to us, San Francisco, that wonderful city where you get the best there is to eat, served in a manner that enhances its flavor and establishes it forever in your memory. Were one to write of San Francisco and omit mention of its gustatory delights, the whole world would protest. For in San Francisco, eating is an art and cooking a science, and he who knows not what San Francisco provides knows neither art nor science. You get the idea. Food is a big deal. 1919, one of the first celebrity chefs in the world. Not the first. Escoffier probably was that. But Victor Hertzler put out the St. Francis Hotel cookbook. Menus and recipes for three meals a day for 365 days a year. Taken from his own kitchen at the St. Francis Hotel. Here's just dinner for Christmas. Blue points mignonette, bisque, salted almond celery, California olives, filet of trout, Café de Paris, sweetbreads braised, puree de mushrooms, roast goose, sweet potatoes, pâté de foie gras, lettuce salad, frozen. It just goes on and on. That's just one meal. Here is, I think we're getting near our time. Here's Doris Muscatine's wonderful book. This, if you were to buy only one book, don't buy mine, buy Doris's 1963. It's a little dated, A Cook's Tour of San Francisco. So today, San Francisco is home to three of the five oldest restaurants in the country. I've looked long and hard, and there are no older ones. The third oldest restaurant in the country is Tadich Grill, 1849. The fifth oldest is my joint, Sam's Grill, 1867. And for San Franciscans, it's a great trivia contest. Okay, what's the one in the middle? All right, I'll give away the answer because I can't call on anybody. It's the old Clam House on Bayshore. It was founded in 1861, and the fire did not go that far, so it was spared the ravages of the 1906 fire. But in addition, we have many other restaurants I haven't that predate 1900, and I have not deeply researched this since I wrote my culinary history of San Francisco. But the Cliff House, which has been intermittent as a restaurant, that first opened in 1858. Jack's restaurant, unfortunately, has gone the way of all flesh. It was founded in 1864, and like the old Clam House, was in its original location at 615 Sacramento Street. Palace Hotel opened in 1875. It had some interruption because of the 1906 fire. Fior d'Italia, the oldest Italian restaurant in the United States. It was clearly that, I grew up in North Beach, it was clearly that in San Francisco. And when new owners bought the place around 1990 something or another, they said they might be the oldest in the country. How would we prove that? And I said, well, what you're trying to do is prove the negative, prove that there is not something, an older restaurant. And I said, that's always hard to do, but try this. Rent the roofs of 50 Checker cabs in New York City for those rooftop signs. Have the sign read, when you're next in San Francisco, visit the oldest Italian restaurant in America, Fior d'Italia, 1886. And if in 3 months you have not been kneecapped, you're it. That's what they did, and that's why they now call themselves the oldest Italian restaurant in the United States. Schroeder's dates from 1893. The only other city that has as many restaurants predating 1900, I'm pretty sure, is New Orleans, which has the second oldest restaurant in the country, Antoine's, 1840. And Boston has the oldest, and that is Union Oyster House, 1826. So we've taken an enormous number of beard awards our restaurants have more modernly. When Moss's restaurant was opened in 1983, it didn't take long for food critics around the world to proclaim it the greatest restaurant in the world. We may not be the second greatest in the world. I have no idea how you would establish that, but we're still a great restaurant city with a fascinating history. Thanks.
John, we have some questions for you.
All right, Roger.
Yes. Do you think it likely that Pioche helped some of those 40 chefs start restaurants?
I don't know. I've not been able to find too much out about Pioche. I went right to Doris Muscatine's sources at the Bancroft Library, and the short answer is I don't know. He may well have. I don't even know how prosperous he may have been. He must have been fairly prosperous to just drop what he was doing. That's a months-long voyage to get to France and then to come back.
Can you comment on the place of the poodle dog in San Francisco's restaurant history?
Yes, the poodle dog, the old poodle dog. I'm sorry it's not there anymore. The original one, like Jack's, like Emilio's, like so many of the old restaurants, had two entrances. The main entrance, where you took your family and, you know, your mother on Mother's Day and everything else. And then a very discreet side entrance, which went upstairs. And that's where you took your, if you were a man, your mistress. And the poodle dog had one of these arrangements. They were called cabinet particulier. My pronunciation is terrible, I apologize. Cabinet particulier. Doris Muscatine writes about that phenomenon in San Francisco restaurants, borrowed from Paris, where, you know, it's a private room, it's got a bathroom, and your drinks and your meals were brought there, and you whispered to the waiter what time you wanted to be awakened in the morning, and you just locked the door when you were done, and didn't want to be bothered by the waiter anymore. But it was a French restaurant. It may well have been established by one of Pioche's companions. And its name was Le Poulet d'Or, the Golden Chicken. And the story is that the coarse miners and, well, you know, think what sort of man, never mind woman, what sort of man would leave, you know, home and hearth, mom, sister, wife, and come out to California all by himself, seeking fame and fortune. You know, some good people, but some pretty rough characters. They couldn't say Le Poulet d'Or, so they just started calling it the Poodle Dog, and the owners gave up. And the family that owned it for many, many years is a French-American family, is still in San Francisco, very prominent.
Great talk from an old Sam's customer. Would France's Tavern in New York come onto the list of oldest restaurants?
I get asked that a lot. And no, and for several reasons. For one thing, it doesn't claim to be. It's been a number of years since I was there. It was closed. I mean, it wasn't even a cafeteria-like place. It was closed for many, many years. The Union Oyster House quite loudly proclaims itself to be the oldest restaurant in the United States. And France's Tavern, which is where Washington gave his farewell address to his troops, has never claimed to be the oldest. It's unclear whether it was even a restaurant as we think of a restaurant back then. The same question could be asked of not of the oldest, but it would slip this restaurant into the top five list, and that is Old Ebbets Bar and Grill in Washington, D.C., which is in a new location. It was forced to move about 40 years ago. that was founded in 1856, I believe. But it was a bar for most of that time, and even its... so there's a fine distinction, you know. Well, what if we served, you know, fresh oysters at the bar? Does that make us a restaurant? There's a restaurant in Connecticut. It's more of a bed and breakfast. Advertises itself as the oldest restaurant in the country, but nobody's buying it. 1780 or something like that. I think it may have been an inn of some sort. But the Union Oyster House is, as I say, vociferously claimed its title. And that would put Antoine's in number two and Tadis is number three. So we have three, four, and five.
What happened to the restaurant scene in San Francisco after the Spanish flu? And what can that potentially tell us to expect for the recovery from COVID-19?
And the short answer is, I don't know. I know people wore masks. I know more about the plague that visited San Francisco because there was a book written about that in the latter part of the 19th century. And that was a matter of rat eradication. But I'm trying to learn everything I can about what the city did with respect to restaurants. In some respects, I'm not in the restaurant business in the sense that I've, made my livelihood that way. This was saving Sam's Grill 6 years ago. It was going to go the way of all flesh. I put together a group and we're like tilting at windmills. We never thought we would experience anything like this. We're not really in a position to influence City Hall policy. We know what's going to be dictated to us. So whenever we can reopen in whatever fashion, takeout did not work for us. But whenever we can reopen, we know we're going to be handed some rules that we have had no say in constructing. Not that we have, our little management group is not that we have any expertise in doing that. But the short answer is, I don't know what happened after the Spanish flu. I know this is all being made up by some very, very well-meaning people. I don't mean to denigrate the process, but we just don't know what's going to happen. And in a way, it's of historical interest to me what happened to restaurants after the Spanish flu epidemic, but it doesn't help us practically speaking. In the meantime, I've got my little law firm I'm trying to keep afloat, and the restaurant we're going to try to reopen, and the museum and the other functions of the Historical Society that we want to get revved up again.
Can you comment about Girard's French restaurant that later in grocery stores sold their salad dressing? Were salads what they were known for?
I remember the restaurant, and I once knew the story, and I know Doris Muscatine talks about it in here. They were one of the first to bottle, their own dressing. And as I remember, it was quite good. And but I can't off the top of my head right now remember. I think I write about Girard's in my book, Tadis Grill. Tadis Grill, it takes its title from the oldest restaurant, but it's really a history of restaurants in San Francisco. And I'm pretty sure I touch on Girard's in there. So either in Doris Muscatine's book or in mine, there may be some information on that.
What are the elements that makes a San Francisco restaurant worthy of recognition? I was thinking of Julius's Castle, which is no more, but may return. Where does that fit in San Francisco's culinary history?
Well, Julius's Castle was, and you and I pronounce it that way, Julius apostrophe S. I think that's the correct way, but I think it's Julius apostrophe Castle on the wall of the restaurant. It's food. I think Bart Shea was the owner when it closed. I could be wrong, but its food was excellent. I would go there because you could get a Caesar salad mixed table side. Where else can you go? I mean, I can't think of a place in San Francisco right now. We have real Caesar dressing at Sam's, but the space between tables is too narrow. We don't do it table side. We make it, we get pasteurized eggs. You could have fooled me. I didn't know you could get a raw egg that has been pasteurized, but you can't. So there's, you have no food poisoning problems. And the darn place is right above the Battery Street and the traffic below, but it was so quiet up there. It was an oasis. I mean, that's a very unusual, that was a very unusual restaurant that had, you know, the elegance of Ernie's, the Blue Fox, La Bourgogne, all these great restaurants that are no more. What was the one, Doro's, just elegance, great service, good food, with that French touch to it. I mean, I like all the ethnic restaurants in San Francisco. You could say that the rich, so the Mandarin restaurant is cited in a very recent book, 10 Restaurants That Changed America. The Mandarin taught America, taught San Francisco and then America about Chinese food. And we've got fabulous Chinese restaurants. So I guess one way, Roger, to answer your question is, well, you could approach it ethnically, but if you strip away ethnic restaurants, what would you call it? San Francisco cuisine, seafood, abundance of seafood, just very, very good preparations, and something that tells you there's a French influence.
What is the city's current policy on construction of fast food and chain restaurants?
I don't know. I know that there was, for many, many years, a virtual ban. I don't know how many years McDonald's fought to be able to put a McDonald's in San Francisco. And being an old fuddy-duddy, I don't want a McDonald's in San Francisco, but, you know, McDonald's has got a right to be in San Francisco. And a lot of people who like that food, and they can afford it, and they can't afford, you know, soup and salad at Sam's. But I don't know the current policy, but I know you see McDonald's all around, and I suppose other chains. But, you know, when I was growing up, it was Mel's. There were a handful of Mel's, Doggy Diner. These were local, but there were more than one. There were chains. Doggy Diner, Phyllis Dillard made a small amount of money giving her name and photograph forever endorsing Doggy Diner. I'm sure she rued the day she ever did that, but as long as that chain was up, her face was plastered all over the place.
Do you think San Francisco will lose one-third of its restaurants as a result of the pandemic?
Well, it pains me to say so, but yeah. And I can tell you the ones most at risk, I learned the hard way that the margins are paper thin, and the least disruption to your business, a fire or something like that, it's just gone. Because you've only got so much cash, bank's not going to lend you anything more. You know, the investors are looking like God, what did you do with the money I gave you before? The reason I say that is one of the critical things in the financing of in the financial operation of a restaurant is space. Now, restaurants that were fortunate enough to have acquired the building they are in, particularly a long time ago, and have paid off the mortgage, you can see it in a heartbeat what a great advantage they have. They don't have mortgage payments, they don't have rent payments, and Prop 13, their property taxes can only go up 2% a year. So we have not been able to acquire the building that Sam's is in. We occupy now the entire first floor. And we're subject to crazy things. We very nearly were able to acquire the building about, I want to say, 3 years ago. And I'm going to make up numbers just so you get the idea. And let's say we were willing to pay $5.4 million for the building. Landlord wanted 5.7. And I'm thinking, well, we're in a poker game. I'm going to be able to get it. And then we're just going to work so hard to pay down the mortgage. And our property taxes will be not frozen, but they can't just keep going up, 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 and up, and up, and up, and up. But here's what happened. Somebody came along Chinese money from mainland China and paid $9 million for the building. I mean, just, it made no sense. There's no way they're making any money off the building. It's a cash suck all along. But what did that sale do to us, the tenant, who had nothing to do with the stupidity of it? The property taxes go up, and a standard San Francisco commercial lease says tenant pays allocable share of property tax increases. All of a sudden, we've got to pay increased property taxes because somebody was willing to pay 50% more than the property was worth just to get their money out of China. We're in that position now. That already happened. But people who, restaurants that own their own buildings, particularly for a long time, where the mortgage is paid off and their property taxes go up only that 2% a year, they have the best chance of surviving. You got to have good food, good service, all that. That's just a given. In a restaurant town as competitive as San Francisco, a restaurant with bad food, bad service does not last long.
How does the rise in quote-unquote ethnic cuisine impact the restaurant scene in future? That includes pop-ups and incubator kitchens.
Well, first, I would argue against the premise of the question that there's a rise in ethnic cuisine. It's been here from the very big beginning. You can read about it in the 1868 article by Noah Brooks. He goes on for pages and pages about all the different ethnic cuisines. He raves about the Chinese restaurants here. He's a man who's famous for a story called The Heathen Chinee, and people get it wrong. He was virulently opposed to racism of any kind, and he was making fun of people, ignorant people who were demeaning the Chinese. But there were three business people here in San Francisco, Nisbet, but they wrote a book together. It's about 600 pages long, The Annals of San Francisco, published in 1855. They saw what happened. They were here for the gold rush and those first 6 years until 1855. They wrote their memoirs. They go on and on about the ethnic diversity in San Francisco. I don't think there was ever a WASP ascendancy. I have a brand new phone behind me that is ringing, and I don't know how to turn it off. I just got it installed yesterday. Let me try this. So they are writing at that time about the tremendous diversity, not only of the people here, on and on and on. I'm walking over to where I have my copy of the book, The Annals of San Francisco, Soule, S-O-U-L-E, Gihon, G-I-H-O-N, and Nisbet. And also they talk about their foods and their restaurants. So I would say there's diversity of ethnic cuisine in San Francisco has been present from the very beginning. And to my observation, the food trucks and that sort of phenomenon, that's just a different way of getting it out there, and getting it out there probably in ways that's a lot less expensive than a restaurant where you have all that fixed overhead you've got to account for. I think that's the case. And every time we have a new wave of, look at the Mission District. People think, oh, that's where the people from Latin America used to be, and now Southeast Asians are coming in. No, it was originally the Jews lived in the Mission District. Then came the Irish. As the Jews moved out to different neighborhoods, then came the Irish. Then came the Latin Americans. You know, I remember when it was largely Irish, then it became Latin American, and now it's Southeast Asian very heavily. Since the Vietnam War ended, that's my take on it. Shoot from the hip.